Coming up on Tech Nation, Walter Isaacson is with us to talk about his latest book, Leonardo da Vinci. Even after all these centuries, there's even more to know about this incredible human, a man who seemed to be interested in everything. And on Tech Nation Health, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft recaps top stories from the Exponential Medicine Conference 2017. And Dr. Ken Horn from Simic Bio talks about the challenges of vein grafts in the arms and legs, a need more common than you might suspect. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 1950, 30% of the U.S. population lived in cities. Today, 80% do. And the world is becoming urbanized. Google anything about the subject, and you see the changes of the last 25 years simply by counting heads in the places they choose to live. Look 25 years before that, and well, life was different. In the United States, looking at its own population growth, there were fears that the entire U.S. would be one big suburb. Freeways everywhere. Everyone would have a car. There were drawings of suburbs throughout the plains and in every mountain meadow. The road from Los Angeles to San Francisco was one long main street. It was a vision left over from the post-war 50s where suburbs were a new concept, where every family could have a car, and the interstate highway system meant you could pack up that family and travel from coast to coast, border to border. The baby boom had arrived, and by the time they were teenagers, every family had cars, plural. Today, the baby boom's baby boom is having a baby boom of its own. And the first boomers, they're living longer and longer, while the natural swell of population from immigration, a tradition in our country, where, of course, we're all immigrants, well, everyone has to be somewhere, and somewhere turns out to be cities. By 2025, the largest city in the world will keep its long-standing record. It's Tokyo, with 36 million people. The only U.S. city in the top 10 is the New York-Newark metropolitan area with 20 million. But these numbers are difficult to comprehend. Take San Francisco, well-known worldwide. The population of the city of San Francisco is a mere 850,000, almost a toy city by comparison. Taking in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's only 7 million people here. So it's time to stop counting people and start looking at what people do and how they want to live. The Bay Area is today snaked by what we generically call Google buses, but really are Google, Cisco, Yahoo, you name it, buses. They drive one way to a workplace in the morning and back at the end of the day, typically with Wi-Fi and specific rules about being quiet, so another hour or two of work or rest or entertainment is guaranteed. Even the short jaunt from South San Francisco and its great bio cluster has its own runs, featuring Genentech's Genenbus, the DNA Shuttle, and others to get you where you want to go, even mass transit. Get off your bus and take an Uber or Lyft the very last mile. The presumption of owning a car has disappeared among these folks, and for good reason. A car doesn't mean status or freedom, it means expense and problems like parking. Well, you can rent a car for a day or an hour, but it's not without its problems. I was shocked recently when I brought up one of the Lyft or Uber apps to find the notice, no cars available. What? I tried again, and then again. The other service came right through. Later that day, I hailed one again, and I looked down to see that the car driving up the university's driveway right then was to meet me. He waved as he drove past, dropped his passenger 50 feet beyond and circled back. 15 seconds between rides? Only with technology. Urbanization looked good. They used to say, people vote with their feet. I'd bet today, people vote with their smartphones. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Walter Isaacson joins us to talk about his new book, Leonardo da Vinci. Yes, after all these years, we find out even more. Then on Tech Nation Health, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft brings news from the Exponential Medicine Conference 2017. And Ken Horn, the CEO of Simic Bio, tells us about the challenges of vein grafts in the arms and legs. You surely know Walter Isaacson from his many books, including Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, Kissinger, and of course, Steve Jobs. He's here today with his latest, Leonardo da Vinci. Well, Walter, welcome back to Tech Nation.
It's wonderful to be back here with you.
Now, first of all, there have been many books, as you know, written about Leonardo da Vinci. And without exception, they're beautiful. I mean, you can't go wrong with the visual material. But the illustrations and the reproductions and even the quality of the paper and how the expanse of
the this is something I learned from Steve Jobs, which is
really
every now and then just try to make it beautiful and spare no expense. And I want to give a real credit to Simon and Schuster because I said, we got to do it on 80-pound stock paper. We have to have it pure white and coated and very, very high quality reproductions of the pictures. And that costs a little bit more. And I said, but I want to keep it below the price of a regular biography. In other words, it shouldn't be more expensive. And, you know, they agreed. They said, yeah, it's worth it. It's Leonardo da Vinci. You don't want to use that sort of uncoated, sort of grainy paper. You're not going to print the Mona Lisa on a Vitruvian man, except for on really high quality paper. And it's sort of the culminating book I'm going to write. And I said, okay, let's see if everything about it. I mean, you know, usually they take the color pictures and put them like in a few pages in the center.
Exactly.
I said, every single page has to be able to do high quality color pictures. And it's interesting. The publishers, when they get all excited, especially Simon & Schuster, say, yeah, let's go for
it. Let's do it. Let's do it. And also when they put a couple of pages all together in the book, obviously that's an easy way to do it, they will put like the Mona Lisa in one corner. You have one
But also page. It won't be right where you're reading it. In other words, when I say, look, you know, his friend Donato Bramante helped him on the Milan Cathedral, and then they went and they did Vitruvian Man, you know, the guy standing spread eagle in the circle in the square, but two other friends were with him and they also drew it. I want you to be looking at that page, whether it be on your ebook or this beautiful physical book, and have it right there. And I can say, look how he turns his foot in a slightly awkward way in order to give you a measurement guide. I don't want you to have to go searching through the book to find, well, let me go look at that.
And when you look at it, it's too small.
Yeah, well, not in this book.
In this book,
it's like, okay, full page for all the pictures.
But we're not talking about a coffee table book. This is a normal book, a thick
and
book.
It should read like a narrative. I mean, I don't want it to be like an art history book or a textbook. It begins with Leonardo being born, ends with him dying, and I hope it feels like a fast-paced narrative.
Well, here on Tech Nation, we're always suckers for information. And the first record of Leonardo was his birth in 1452 in the notebook of his grandfather, Antonio. Take us there.
Antonio is a notary, just like Leonardo's father is a notary, and just like the great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather were. Long line of notaries But Leonardo has a stroke of good luck, which is he's born out of wedlock. So he can't be the notary, you know, because it's handed down to the first legitimate child. And this is great because he would be
A terrible notary.
Yeah, right, exactly. This is not his thing, which is, you know, he thought out of the box. Notaries are supposed to think in the box. And so Leonardo doesn't get sent to a traditional to school, and he has to teach himself. And he adopts something any good techie would adopt as a motto, which is disciple of experience. In other words, if he's given a piece of received wisdom, the first thing he does is question it, saying, how do we test that? How can we see if that's right? And so instead of getting all that dusty scholasticism of medieval scholars crammed into his head, or to break things into disciplines and say, well, this is art and this is engineering and this is anatomy, the way they were doing at the universities of the time, he believed that he should just look at all the patterns of nature, all disciplines, all fields, all topics interesting. He wanted to know everything that he could figure out about everything that could be possibly known. He was the most curious person in history.
It's very interesting. I've finally understood in one continuum so much of how everything came together. People say, well, how could he do all these different things?
I'm not even sure he thought they were that different. It's like Steve Jobs. I'm not sure he thought engineering and art were that different.
It reminded me of someone whose name I won't mention, but people would know him if I did, who didn't happen to go to college, but just read and experienced and did all these things. And a lot of people don't realize it even today. But because of that, he doesn't have the silos of this is this topic, this is this topic.
You've got it exactly right. You don't want to get caught in silos. And when Leonardo looks at swirls of water in the rivers near his childhood home in Vinci, or then at the Arno when it goes through Florence, he looks at swirls of hair as well. And you see in his notebooks, I mean, my book is based not on his artworks, just his artworks, but on his notebooks. We got more than 7,000 pages. And almost every one of them has some form of that spiral of swirling water, water swirling into a bowl, the blood in the heart swirling, it goes from one ventricle to another, the curls of hair, whirlwinds and tempests, and even some stabs at the underlying math, the Fibonacci equations.
Now, just to sort of put us in a framework, you know, we can't say, well, he wouldn't have been a notary, so it must have come down from mom's side. Let's just review really quickly. What does being a notary mean in 15th century
Italy? That would be somewhat like being a contracts lawyer. He was not a litigator, but somebody who drew up elaborate contracts and wills. It was a upper middle class job. In fact, his father did some for the Medici family, which were obviously the top dogs in Florence at the time.
And his mother, I'm amazed we find these out throughout the book. It was just in 2017 that Oxford art historian Martin Kemp and archival researcher Giuseppe Palanti, they produced some new documentation.
Yeah, I worked with Martin Kemp quite a bit, who's a great old Oxford don, who's written so much good stuff, academic and on Leonardo. And there's still things left to discover, like who his mother was. We knew from a tax document her first name, Caterina, but people said she was probably an Arab slave or African or maybe from the Asia or what. No, she was a 14-year-old peasant girl from Vinci who gets pregnant, and the Vinci family takes care of her. They pay her dowry to be married to somebody who works on their farm because Leonardo's father was already contracted to be married to somebody else. So even though he was out of wedlock, he was raised in a loving community with both his birth mother, his stepmother, and his father all involved in raising him.
Now, we're looking at this beginning, if you will, and we could go along and talk about Da Vinci, but I want to talk about those darn notebooks.
Oh, man, they're so cool. And, you know, I'm going to go up to Seattle. Bill Gates bought one of them, the Codex Lester, it's called, which is one of the scientific, in fact, the most beautiful of the science notebooks. And you see Leonardo there looking at how you would measure the sun and also how water gets to the top of mountains to become mountain streams. And he tries to figure out what he calls the macrocosm of the Earth and how it connects to us as humans, something you see reflected in the Mona Lisa, which is how do we fit in to the Earth and into the ages. And some of the previous writers about Leonardo, who are mainly art critics in the 20th century, they say, oh, he wasted so much time on geology and on physics and on science and math in these notebooks like the ones Bill Gates has. If he had only not wasted that time, he would have painted more paintings. And I say, yeah, but the Mona Lisa answers you with a smile, because the Mona Lisa smile comes from having dissected the 30 different cadavers to get every muscle in the human face right. It comes from having dissected the eye to realize that if you're staring right at something, like the lips of the Mona Lisa, you see the tiny details of black and white. But if you're looking at it sort of from an angle, you see the colors and shadows. So that's why the Mona Lisa smile is interactive. It's like a virtual reality. It flickers depending on how closely you're looking at it. So all of these things are in the science and technology and engineering notes, as well as the art notes that he keeps. And I just had a grand old time geeking out on page after more than 7,000 pages. And you say, wow, I really get to know this guy. I mean, one of the notebook pages I love, you know, has this craggy old warrior, the sketches for the Last Supper, but there's also he's trying to square the circle, which is one of his, you know, passions for his whole life, because he likes transforming one shape into another shape and having the same area. But at the very bottom left of the page, the last thing he wrote was a recipe for taking nuts and boiling them in oil and making hair dye that's blonde or tawny, he calls it. And I realized there he is turning, he's in his 30s, muscular guy, really good looking. That guy in Vitruvian Man, that naked guy spread akimbo and the circle and scratch, that's Leonardo. I mean, that's his flowing hair. He's just doing a self-portrait. And in that flowing blonde hair, you realize that he's kind of like us. He's human. It's like, I'm turning gray. How do I dye my hair?
It happens to everybody. You're listening.
Well, look at my hair. Oh. Yeah.
The beauty of radio, Walter. The beauty of radio.
I know. I have a hair look that's made for radio.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Walter Isaacson. You know him well from his extensive career, CEO of the Aspen Institute, chairman of CNN, editor of Time Magazine. And you surely know his books, including Einstein, His Life and Universe, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, Kissinger, A Biography, and of course, Steve Jobs. He's university professor of history at Tulane, and he's here today with his latest book, Leonardo da Vinci. Well, one of the things that I got about those pages is that they weren't like all organized. This is it. And now pages over here to do this. Everything was all together. How now, if I were to show you another page from Leonardo, how do you scan it? What do you look for?
Well, the great thing is that paper was a bit expensive, so he crams every corner of the page, as you just said, you know, with his thoughts. So you see that they're written with rhyme but not reason. In other words, he skips all around things that catch his fancy, and they're vaguely connected. Like on one of the pages I love is a craggy old warrior, but it's the mountain ranges coming out of the back. But then out of the mountain ranges, he's doing triangles with circles in them because he's still trying to square the circle. And it's sort of the shape of the mountains. And then growing into the torso of the warrior is a tree, because Leonardo has discovered what is Leonardo's law of branching, which is if you have a tree trunk and it branches, say, into three branches, the combined area of the three branches will equal the combined area of the trunk. And he realizes from his dissections that's the same with our blood vessels. So he has the tree sort of blending in to the blood vessels, just like, say, in the Mona Lisa, you have that wonderful river curving into her blood vessels. So you see the connections he makes. And you said earlier on, don't let ourselves be siloed. Don't do that to our kids. Don't be that way in your life, thinking I'm only an engineer, I only do circuits, you know, or for that matter, I only do poetry, I don't know what a processor does. Don't be that way, because on his notebook pages, he is seeing the patterns of nature across all sorts of disciplines, and he realizes that it's those patterns that are beautiful.
And of course, if you've been studied all these years, there's plenty of theories about this or that or whatever. And the mirror writing. Why the mirror writing? I've heard 50 reasons. Let's talk. Tell people what
well,
that
sometimes
is.
It's not as bad of a conspiracy as people think. Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code is a great novel, but all those conspiracy theories aren't right. And I am sure that the reason he writes in mirror script, meaning that it starts on the right-hand side of the page, moves to the left, and all the letters are backwards, etc., is because he is left-handed. And back then, we didn't have Sharpies and ballpoints. So you'd smear the ink if you, and most lefties kind of get that because they, sometimes they write, you know, with their hand turned around or whatever. But it was not totally uncommon for a left-hander who didn't go to school to write from right to left. Now, when he went to sort of an abacus school doing math, they forced him to do the numbers in the traditional way. But since he mainly was unschooled, and he was unusual because he was unschooled but very literate, which wasn't all that usual in 1470. So he writes from right to left so as not to smudge the ink. But it does also make it a little harder for other people to read his writing. And he was a bit sometimes secretive about his intellectual property.
He didn't have to hold it up to a mirror to read it.
Oh, no. He could read it, and so could some. There's a wonderful painting of him and Donato Bramante, because he had so many close friends. And Bramante does this painting, and you see the glowing, curling blonde hair of Leonardo and that rugged physique that you can see in Vitruvian Man in that face. And there's a notebook in front of him done in mirror script, because Bramante, likes to show Leonardo with his notebooks. Everybody was amused by them.
Now, these notebooks are everywhere now.
It is very, very lucky for a biographer of Leonardo when you say, okay, let me go find those notebooks, and you'll figure out, oh, they're in Florence and Venice and Milan and in Paris and in London and in Windsor Castle and Madrid and, of course,
Seattle.
Bill Gates, his house. And you think, this will be a wonderful trip. And I kind of wandered around just looking at the notebooks, and they've never been gathered all in one place. So it's kind of fun. You go to Milan, and you see the Codex of the Flight of Birds at the Biblioteca Ambrosiana. You go to Venice, fourth floor of the Academy, you get to see Vitruvian Man, which is kept in storage up there. And I was very lucky. My wife actually ran into somebody who has a strong connection to Windsor Castle, and was able to get us into the library of Windsor Castle, where all the great anatomy drawings are, including the awesomely beautiful fetus in the womb done in white red chalk, which is, you've got my book in front of me, it's the opening frontispiece of the book.
Which reminds me, you know, we keep looking at this sort of intersection of science and art, but saying that alone tells you you're not talking Leonardo speak. He didn't see it. It was
continuous. Somebody asked me recently, do you think he would have thought of himself as an artist or an engineer? Because that's his title with the Duke of Milan and the King of France, his last patron, is, you know, engineer and painter to the king or to the duke. And I said, I don't think he would have made that distinction. Almost the way Steve Jobs didn't make that distinction. When Steve Jobs was doing the original iPod, it wasn't like he said, well, let's do this for art reasons and this for engineering reasons. Engineering is just a form of capturing nature's beauty. Even an equation is just like the good Lord's brushstroke for something in reality. And if you look at a mathematical equation, just like Ada Lovelace did, Ada Lovelace, Lord Byron's daughter, comes up with the first computer algorithm. I wrote about her in a previous book. And she looked at her father's poetry, a line like, she walks in beauty like the night. Somewhat interesting, beautiful line, but you have to think about it. And she compared it to a mathematical equation. That also describes something in a mysterious way. So I think the beauty of people like Ada Lovelace, Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, but above all, Leonardo da Vinci, is that they don't make a clean distinction between engineering and art.
We all know about the cadavers and the peeling back of the skin and that sort of thing. But it really came alive for me when you put the list in that he had written for himself about what he wanted to find out, the twitch of the lips, what activated. So cadavers no longer move.
Yeah, that's right.
But these were underlying, you know, how he wasn't just saying, oh, where are the muscles? It's like, how does it all work?
You know, painters at the time sometimes did what was called surface dissections. They'd look at the skin and, you know, so that they could get the body right. Leonardo had one of those, you know how you geek out sometimes when you're looking at something on Wikipedia and soon an hour and a half later you've gone down rabbit holes? Leonardo was that way. Instead of just doing the surface, he would then go down layer by layer. And soon he was dissecting the organs and the nerves and the spinal cord and all the things that were way beyond what he needed to paint, you know, St. Jerome in the wilderness, say. But he did it because of pure curiosity. And then he started trying to figure out which muscles are controlled by nerves that go to the brain, which ones from the spinal cord. And so he would say, what makes us yawn? What makes our lips twitch? All these things that you and I wondered when we were kids, but after we outgrew our wonder years, people kind of said, quit asking questions, or, you know, you just went on. The cool thing about Leonardo is throughout his life, he's asking those same questions we asked during our wonder years, like, why is the sky blue? And he'd do sprays of water with light coming through it to test how you can make a blue sky, how it would be a misty sky. He even uses purified water and water with impurities to see what changes the diffraction of the light. These are the science experiments that we used to do in eighth grade. And Leonardo's, one of the things that made him so cool was not that he was some superhuman, you know, mental processing power like Einstein. He was so cool because even when he's 30 or 40, he's still doing science projects
never
and saying
stops.
The beauty.
Yeah. He never stops. And
one of my favorites is the tongue of the woodpecker. There's a list every week. He writes himself a list of what I need to know. How do they walk on ice in Flanders? How do they make them, you know, ask so-and-so to show me how to do a measurement of the sun? Describe the tongue of the woodpecker. I did a double take. Who wakes up one morning and wants to know what the tongue of a woodpecker looks like? How would you even find out? I mean, grab a woodpecker and, you know. And yet, it was so purely Leonardo, curiosity for its own sake. And after laughing about it, I kept coming back at it. And I don't want to spoil the book, but the last two paragraphs of the book are a coda. Because if you're curious, and you should be curious by the end of the book, you kind of want to know.
I'm speaking with Walter Isaacson, the author of Leonardo da Vinci. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation, Biotech Nation, and Tech Nation Health are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Tech Nation Health, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft reviews Exponential Medicine 2017. And Dr. Ken Horn from Simic Bio talks about the challenges of vein grafts in the arms and legs. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Walter Isaacson, the author of Leonardo da Vinci. What flips the script, if you will, is that normally we look at the works of Leonardo as the big, big thing, and Leonardo did this and that, and that. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the perception. I came away with the Venn diagram on this, as we engineers and mathematicians do. Okay, there's a little circle. It's all the art and the work and the sculpture and the engineering and design. That's the little circle. The big circle is it's the center of Leonardo's great mind and how he worked.
He had the most noble of all quests, which at some point in life, as Steve Jobs did later in his life, and I hope we all do, it's not only to just take things out of the river of history, but put things into the river of history. And more importantly, to not only try to know things for the sake of it being useful, that you know how Boolean algebra can, you know, or how C++ coding can do some particular function. It's to learn things for the pure joy of knowing them, curiosity for its own sake. And that allows you to take the grandest of steps, which is not only to understand the world around us, but also understand how we fit in. That's what Vitruvian Man is a symbol of. It's not just the Earth and the cosmos, but it's that self-portrait of Leonardo saying, how do I fit in? And that was his grand quest, to know everything you can know about the cosmos, including how he fit into it.
Comprehending how his life was shaped by his beginnings is also very, very interesting. You know, this sense of the impact of the illegitimacy, the relation of father, the relation of the not having a recognized father, if you will, in a legitimate sense, and patronage, which he had to continue to seek throughout his life.
The cool thing about being born when he was is, first of all, it's much more tolerant. You can be gay, left-handed, illegitimate, vegetarian, misfit, or heretic like he was, and fit right into Florence. But, you know, it does make you feel like a bit of an outsider. And one of the ways that's reflected in Leonardo's life is he was always, as you just said, on a quest for the perfect patron. Now, this is kind of good because the Renaissance is known for its patrons. You're in Florence at that period, and Lorenzo de' Medici is around. So, you know, he becomes a bit of a patron, not a good patron, but okay patron. Leonardo then goes to Milan to do the Duke of Milan. He makes a mistake in life, which is he likes strong-willed men. Now, if you're Freud or if you're a Freudian or if you're a psychologist, you can say, okay, absent father, somewhat distant, never legitimates him. I'm looking for the really strong father. He works for Caesar Borgia, the worst warlord. He and Niccolo Machiavelli together in a small town in Imola for about 4 months. They're working for Borgia, the horrible warlord. Finally, Leonardo quits. The collaborationists, you know, we see this collaborationist instinct in our country today. But finally, he quits. And he finds his last patron, a really great patron, which is Francis I of France. So with his paintings, Leonardo's unfinished paintings, including the Mona Lisa, packed on mules, he crosses the Alps and in his 60s and finds the great Francis I as his patron.
You didn't do this over a long weekend.
I did it over 20 years, actually. My wife studied and, well, she did her junior year abroad in Florence. And so we used to go back and see, I love the Uffizi. I love the notebooks that you find there and then go up to Milan and find others. And I was always gathering string. And at a certain point, the pattern of the books I had written, Leonardo's so great at discovering patterns, right? He can say, okay, here's all these things. Here's how the heart valve works. And it's sort of like the way a tree works and the way a river works, et cetera. Having done Benjamin Franklin and then Einstein and then Steve Jobs, I said, okay, I now see this pattern, which is the people who cross disciplines and connect engineering to art are the really cool creative people. And so having gathered string for 20 years, just being a Leonardo fanatic, and by fanatic, I mean I loved his science and geology and anatomy as well as his paintings, I said, okay, I'm now going to buckle down. And it's sort of the final mountain you're going to climb if you're going to do cross-disciplinary genius.
We know he has more notebooks than are known. Do you think we'll find more?
Yeah, of course we will. We have, I think, by my calculation, about 7,200 pages that I was able to look around in various places. Every now and then, another notebook or two pops up. For example, in Madrid, we have what are now called the Codices Madrid. Great engineering, where he tries perpetual motion and discovers why you can't do perpetual motion, which leads him to work on friction and do ball bearings. He invents ball bearings because he's worked on perpetual motion. All in these Madrid notebooks that turned up, I don't know, 40, 50 years ago. I will say that by having one quarter of all of his output, let us guess, that we have, that's better than the percentage of emails from Steve Jobs and memos of his life that I had. And frankly, if my grandchildren or great-grandchildren are ever to look at my stuff, all my tweets and Facebook posts, and, you know, I'm old enough to have stuff that's gone down the black hole of MySpace or AOL, yeah, you know, message boards or the well's still around. You know, paper's a great technology. It is really good for the storage and retrieval of information. And after 500 years, we have a lot of Leonardo's notebooks. One piece of advice I'd give the techies listening now is every evening or so, or maybe every morning, take notes on paper. It's a great technology. Write your to-do list, write a few thoughts, put it in a notebook, and 50 years from now, 500 years from now, you're not going to have somebody try to figure out what's the operating system of this notebook. It's on paper, and they'll be able to retrieve it.
Now, did you allude earlier, did I hear in one of your responses that this might be the penultimate you may be
done? Well, the
done?
Ultimate.
Certainly the ultimate. Yeah.
Well, I think it's probably the final book in what, as I said, emerges a pattern. I didn't realize I was writing about creativity. I mean, I stumbled across doing Ben Franklin because I had done Henry Kissinger, and I was interested in realism, the balance of power diplomacy. And Franklin was a great practitioner of that when he was balancing the Bourbon-backed nations off against England during the Revolution. But then I realized his electricity experiments, we think of him as a doddering old dude flying a kite in the rain. No, those were real serious experiments. So I got interested in the connection of science, et cetera. And after a while, I realized, okay, I'm writing a series of biographies about people who looked across disciplines and thus became more creative. It's just that simple. And they're really books about creativity. What is it? How do you achieve it? I don't think I'll do another one. I mean, this is sort of the big final mountain. I'm going to move back to New Orleans, my hometown. I'm sure I'm going to write a book or so that involves race and jazz and crossing the color line and other things in New Orleans, but they'll be smaller books. This is supposed to be the culmination of how do you achieve creative genius.
Well, Walter, always a pleasure. You know, you're welcome. You don't have to write another book to come and see us.
Oh, now you tell me. Oh, great. Well, I'll see you next week.
Thanks, Walter. My guest today is Walter Isaacson. The book is Leonardo da Vinci. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. Today on Tech Nation Health, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft recaps top stories from the Exponential Medicine Conference 2017. And Dr. Ken Horn from Simic Bio talks about the challenges of vein grafts in the arms and legs, more common than you might suspect. And now, Chief Correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft.
So Exponential Medicine 2017 was amazingly our eighth program held down at the sort of beautiful Hotel Del Coronado in San Diego. We had over 800 folks there from 36 countries, multiple industries, and what happens in exponential medicine is, unlike most medical conferences, it sort of unsilos healthcare from different sorts of clinicians to patients to biotech folks to pharma to payers to technologists. So we spent 4 days there. And you know, this year, you know, our sort of first day is always a bit of exponentials 101. What's happening in AI, robotics, 3D printing, nanotech, genomics? How are they converging? We get people up to speed. And one of the interesting examples we had this year was last year we had faculty, including Larry Smarr, who is an astrophysicist turned sort of big data and quantified self junkie, who met Catherine Moore, the head of strategy at Intuitive Surgical. And they met at last year's conference. And this, since then, they conspired to actually help fix his very specific inflammatory bowel disease element. And they did a very unique approach, using augmented reality, using 3D representations of his colon, and collaborating with his surgeon to the first of its kind sort of personalized surgery that literally took out the exact component of his colon. And since then, he had a dramatic recovery, including the normalization of his microbiome and his inflammatory markers went down. And it was an example of folks meeting last year, converging and coming up with a new kind of personalized surgical approach with robotics, with big data, with augmented reality. It could be the foreshadowing of new ways of doing surgery. So that was sort of a catalyst from 2016, now actualized in 2017. So beyond our sort of intro to exponentials, one of the themes that was sort of evident this year was sort of the empowered patient. Someone like Professor Larry Smarr from UCSD is empowered. He's 3D printed his own colon. He's used big data. But we also had patients like Michael Series, who is the 11th patient in the United Kingdom to get a bowel transplant because he had a bad form of inflammatory bowel disease as well, Crohn's. And he wanted to address one of his big unmet needs, which is often undiscussed in healthcare, but having an ostomy bag, which collects feces, not too sexy. But many of those patients don't know when they're full. They can break and leak. So he created a whole way of digitizing his bag and giving it an app to collect and understand when his bag was full. And now that's being commercialized. An example of someone solving their own problem as an empowered patient using technology. A third example was really interesting. Chad Ruffin, who is an ENT doctor, just finished his training. He's the very first congenitally deaf-born individual with now cochlear implants, basically a brain-computer interface for hearing, who made it through residency training. And now he's been using his knowledge of computer science and being a patient and an ENT doctor to improve the algorithms and software that goes into those cochlear implants that can dramatically improve a deaf person's ability to understand music and speech and intonation. So part of the theme of exponential medicine is not that the future is being driven by the technologists and the docs and the biopharma folks, but that you need engaged and empowered patients, the idea of patients included, and nurses included, and family members included. And that was one of the sort of overlying themes. A third theme that I think is super important that we touched on this year was the social determinants of health. The fact that while our genomics and how our diet might be important, it's really how much access you might have to actual healthy foods, access to vaccinations, education levels. All those things have huge numbers of disparities. Folks in the United States who have low income have six times the rate of developing type 2 diabetes, as an example, compared to higher income, much higher rates of depression and other comorbidities. And if we spend a little more time and attention on social support, whether it's school lunches, access to vaccines, access to information about health, we can make a huge difference. So we really, I think, illuminated that area as well as technology solutions to help impact that. Companies like Uber and Lyft now are bringing patients to clinics who didn't have access or easy transportation, for example. So connecting the dots in that way. And the third area that was sort of a highlight, I think, of exponential medicine this year was sort of the future of clinical practice, the way that virtual reality, augmented reality is exploding and converging with fields like artificial intelligence. How do you take this big data, whether it's about anatomy or understanding the cardiovascular system or big data about genomics, and make it visual and understandable? How do you translate to using that to helping train surgeons or medical students or patients themselves to understand a clinical course? And there's some amazing, you know, exploding technology there that's really starting to hit the clinic, the operating room, and, you know, even gamifying healthcare. And part of all this can be overwhelming. There's so much happening. You just had a great session talking about Leonardo da Vinci. We had Michael Gelb there who ran a session about how to think like Leonardo da Vinci. We want to get the folks at exponential medicine and beyond getting out of their headspace and mixing it up and learning some of those tools that Leonardo so embodied, which include, you know, my Italian's terrible, but inspiratio and connexia, and kind of the theme of bringing fields and technologies together and beauty and thinking in new ways. And I think that's part of what happens in exponential medicine and where part of the solutions we're going to have to grand challenges in health and medicine across the planet will come from.
It's always in November.
Always in November. The website exponentialmedicine.com has a lot of the talks from both this year and prior years. And again, we cross the whole spectrum, everything from chatbots in healthcare to genomics and CRISPR, the future of cancer, using new approaches for mental health. We had a great talk this year from someone from a group called MAPS, which is looking at using MDMA, often used and or known as a party drug, that's now being applied to PTSD. We had a session on this show about some of the new approaches to mental health. They were able to show that folks who had PTSD for often 18 or more years, with psychotherapy, about 20% would get better. But psychotherapy blended with three individualized doses of MDMA had 56% of those folks recovering long-term from long-term PTSD. So new approaches, blending old drugs, new drugs, and new approaches.
I think one of the things that's so interesting for me is all the different kinds of people who are there. This isn't a medical conference in the sense that all these MDs are walking around nodding at each other, wearing nice clothes. Yeah. It's like, no, this is all kinds of folks.
Well, number one,
everything.
And we're at the beach. People let their hair down a bit. We had 36 countries there represented. I often tell people, don't sit next to people you know. Mix it up. We have some innovation games from how to build the tallest marshmallow using string and spaghetti that gets people sort of mixing up in new ways. And, you know, a theme across any field is that we're often stuck in our old mindsets. You know, pharma companies are sort of structured the way they've been for decades. Big companies that are being disrupted by newer ones often can get killed by the fact that they're not just innovating, but not creating the pathways for new things to be invented. They may be thinking quarter to quarter. They often have antibodies against innovation that happens in their own company. So part of it is getting folks mixing it together. One magical thing that's happened in the last 5 years, led by Lucien Englin, who's a real healthcare instigator at the Netherlands, is at Exponential Medicine, groups to get from around the world come together in this new global network of health innovators. So that's a lesson from Amsterdam or from Latin America or from Japan or from New York can be shared and synthesized. We don't need to repeat the same pilot studies. We can democratize the lessons of healthcare, whether it's a clinical trial for a drug or digiceutical or a new platform, without having to do a clinical trial at every medical center.
And it'll be next November again?
November 4th through 7th. The website, again, exponentialmedicine.com. And we encourage all types of folks to come and participate. This year we live streamed the event. So if you go to our website and look under videos, you can find both videos and the complete live stream of the event. And again, we want to democratize this information. We had 4 days of a lot of content. You know, I've just finished up the first part of my Aspen Institute Healthcare Innovators Fellowship, and Aspen Institute, led by Walter Isaacson. I did a venture, and my venture was to build a healthcare connectome, a bit of a super mind map for understanding technologies, how they overlap, where the cross connections might be, where it's from 3D printing to robotics to drones to chatbots. Kind of map that space out, both where we are and where things are heading. That website we just launched is a sort of early platform. It's healthcare-connectome.com. We'd love folks to go online and try it and start building out maps for any area, including in healthcare, so that we can start to, you know, build out a vision of what's here and where things are heading, unmet needs, unmet challenges, and hopefully then find collaborations and connections, how you can converge technologies to address solutions, sometimes with today's technology, sometimes with what's coming in 2020, 2025.
Well, Daniel, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent of TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. We're all familiar with heart bypass surgery, where veins are taken from other places in the body and rerouted to help the heart function. We're less familiar with similar vein grafts in such places as the legs. Dr. Ken Horn is the CEO of Simic Bio.
Like you mentioned, Moira, the procedure is very similar to the heart. We're going to take this healthy vein and surgically bypass the diseased artery. And much like in the heart, those veins can fail. Now, the procedures in the leg have not gotten as much attention as they have in the heart because our healthcare system is biased towards if you're going to die from this procedure, we need to make sure it goes well.
So we go, yeah, the heart's really an essential part.
Yep, yeah, right up there with the brain. So those outcomes are actually pretty good. Bypass surgery outcomes are pretty good in the heart. In the peripheral space, there are different things. The leg actually moves around a lot more than the heart does. The lesions or the disease parts are much longer. Instead of a couple centimeters, they can be 10 to 15 to 20 centimeters of diseased area. So they're procedural things that just make it a lot more complicated. Even though the procedure is in concept similar, the outcomes are still much worse in the peripheral space.
Now, how does this graft happen?
They take the healthy vein out of the opposing leg, and they use that to attach across the diseased artery. So now blood can flow through the healthy vein instead of through the diseased artery. And very interestingly, that healthy vein over 5 to 10 years will actually remodel to become an artery. And that will become the primary conduit instead of the artery. Now, the problem is that's a successful outcome. The problem is if it doesn't mature successfully, if it scars down, then that vein, which is now the lifeline for that limb, has clotted off. It's blocked off.
We're in the same trouble again.
And we're in the same trouble again. But, by the way, the number of options has now gone down by one. You don't have infinite number of veins in your opposite leg to go through there. There's only so many procedures you can do. And so at some point, amputation becomes the outcome.
Now, what have you done at Simic Bio that could change that?
So when these veins are placed into bypass the artery, there's unfortunately some injury that happens to them, and the body kind of attacks them, even though it really shouldn't. And it triggers.
Even though it's yours, you've taken it out of one side, it goes into the other, it says, wait a minute, something's going on here.
It is, exactly. Now, it's not like a organ transplant rejection, it's a very different process. It's actually the process of moving the vein from one side to the other actually just causes some injury to it. And that injury, the body responds to appropriately, which is actually to create some scar tissue. But scar tissue inside this lifeline for your leg is not a good thing. And that's what Simic is trying to address.
What's the principle here?
So the injury is really perpetuated from this cell lining inside the vessel called the endothelium. It's kind of like the skin inside your vessel. And the act of taking the vein from the healthy side and bypassing the artery actually causes a lot of damage to this endothelium such that that cell layer kind of falls off. Think of a lot of your skin falling off, right? It's not a pleasant
thought. We want to do the whole thing intact from one leg to the other.
Exactly. Now, the body responds to that injury, much like if you ripped a bunch of skin off, saying, okay, something's wrong here. I'm going to recruit some my immune response and generate some inflammation such that I can make sure that this quote-unquote injury gets healed. The problem is that injury response causes technically smooth muscle cell proliferation with this fibrotic scarring inside the vessel, and that can perpetuate all the way to the point that that vein gets blocked off again.
Well, sure, if you cut anything on yourself, it's going to create a scar. That is to protect you.
Correct.
It thinks it's helping you, and in this case, it's not. How can that be avoided?
So, again, evolutionarily, these mechanisms make a lot of sense if you got your finger cut off.
Yeah.
Right? But that's not what's happening here. We didn't evolve with brilliant thoracic surgeons going in there and conducting these procedures for us. What our drug does is it actually changes the body's response to these injuries. It's all driven from the extracellular matrix, which is the focus of our company. And it helps
now,
the body.
Now, what's the extracellular matrix? I didn't even know I had one.
Oh, you have it all over yourself.
Oh, it's everywhere. Okay.
It's everywhere. The matrix is everywhere more.
I see.
The extracellular matrix is the non-cellular component of your tissue. If I stripped off all the cells from a chunk of tissue, you'd look like a big sponge. That's all extracellular matrix.
So they're holding all the cells together.
Yeah, it's kind of like a home for the cells. And things like collagen, hyaluronic acid, laminin are key proteins that are incorporated in part of the matrix. We've known about things like collagen for decades and decades and decades, but we haven't pursued the matrix as a therapeutic very much. And what do I mean by that? Most of the drugs that we encounter today, they have a cell biology target. Something inside the cell, like your genes or something on the cell surface or cell signaling, that's what most of our industry is focused on. The matrix is equally biologically active, and yet we haven't approached it to develop drugs that actually impact it or affect it in a way that could be beneficial. So we think we're opening up a whole new category of therapeutics by addressing the matrix.
So what's Simic Bio done that's different from sort of the traditional standard procedure?
Sure. So what we've done is that when they harvest that healthy vein, they typically prep it and put it in a bucket of solution to keep it hydrated before they implant it again. And during that process, injury is constantly occurring to this vessel, which the body will eventually attack once it's placed into the patient.
Oh, so just having been removed and sitting in solution is part of what causes the injury that has to be the body responds to. Okay, so you're trying to stop that injury.
Absolutely. We're trying to prevent the body from responding to that injury. Okay, the body recognizes the injury and cannot differentiate between something that happened out in the savannah and happened in the OR. So we're not actually stopping the injury from occurring. Our compound is in the solution that they bathe the vein in, and our drug sticks to these injured spots such that when it's implanted, the body no longer unnecessarily responds to those injured areas, and it just heals faster.
Well, I know the FDA was interested in this because you were in phase one and a two going into this, and they said, why don't you just go to phase three?
We feel incredibly fortunate to be working with the cardiorenal division at the FDA. As you can imagine, based on what you just heard, where they recommended to us that we proceed with a phase three, a single phase three at that, they've been very supportive and I think very strategic in terms of looking at a patient population that's underserved, right? The cardiac indication gets a lot more attention than the peripheral indication, and thinking about how we can help companies get drugs to these patients that are really needed. And again, it's been a really wonderful experience working with them.
Well, you saved yourself 4, 5, 6 years, right?
Correct.
And we can get like these that. To patients.
Yeah, it was about 3 years off our timeline. And essentially, the FDA's rationale, which makes a lot of sense, is even in our latter phase 2B studies that we were proposing, we were going after clinical outcomes. We were trying to show benefit to these patients. And as they saw it, this was not that different from a phase 3. Why not have a shot on goal at the end of this for this patient to actually be able to get access to this drug rather than having another 3 years of development on top of that?
So you're going right to phase 3. How many patients do you expect to work on with this?
So we think it's about a 1,000-patient trial. That's relatively small for the cardiorenal division at the FDA, but the final details of which we are still in discussion with ourselves and our cardiac advisors, as well as with the FDA as well. But that's probably the right ballpark.
So we might see this on the open market in 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, 2021 is kind of what we're targeting for launch right
your
now.
Your target now, 20, that's pretty exciting. Would you also go into hearts?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think as a small biotech company, we need to be focused on our clinical development and make sure we get one thing rather than trying to go after five things at the same time. But those patients also have opportunities for improvement, not necessarily in the broad patient population. There are specific patients within the cardiac bypass surgery who don't do so well. There are patients who are getting bypass surgery, for example, who have kidney failure, who have challenges associated with that. So depending on what partnerships we get involved in, we'd absolutely like to bring this drug to other indications as well.
Well, Ken, so exciting. Please come back. Keep us updated, won't you?
Thank you, Moira, for taking the time. Absolutely will.
Dr. Ken Horn is the CEO of Simic Bio. More information is available at simicbio.com. That's S-Y-M-I-C, simicbio.com. For Tech Nation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.